Welcome to this Forthright Radio for March 17th, 2010. I'm Joy LeClaire. We are fortunate to have Phyllis Bennis for our guest today for the full hour. We'll be opening the phone lines later to your questions and comments. Phyllis Bennis directs the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. The Middle East component of the project challenges the drive towards U.S. empire in that region and beyond, focusing particularly on ending the U.S. wars and occupation in Afghanistan and Iraq, and supporting a just and comprehensive peace based on an end to Israeli occupation and apartheid policies in Palestine. The United Nations component analyzes U.S. domination in the U.N. and attempts to strengthen the potential role of the U.N. as part of a new internationalism and global resistance to empire. Since September 11, 2001, the New Internationalism Project has also been involved in examining the root causes of and critiquing U.S. responses to that tragedy. Phyllis Bennis is also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She has been a writer, analyst, and activist on Middle East and UN issues for many years. While working as a journalist at the UN during the run-up to the 1990-91 Gulf War, she began examining U.S. domination of the UN, and she stayed involved in work on Iraq's sanctions and disarmament, and later was a delegation of congressional aides to Iraq to examine the impact of U.S.-led economic sanctions on humanitarian conditions there. And later, she joined the former UN Assistant Secretary General Dennis Halliday, who had resigned his position as humanitarian coordinator in Iraq to protest the impact of sanctions. In 2001, she helped found and remains on the steering committee of the U.S. campaign to end Israeli occupation. She works closely with the United for Peace and Justice Anti-War Coalition, co-chairs the UN-based International Coordinating Network on Palestine, and since 2002 has played an active role in the growing global peace movement. She continues to serve as an advisor to several top UN officials on Middle East and UN democratization issues. Phyllis Bennis, you've written many books. I won't list them, but we will be speaking today about your latest book, Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer. Thank you so much for joining us on KZYXNZ.
Very glad to be with you in California today.
Of course, we just heard from Amy Goodman the latest news of what's happening with the Palestinian issue in Israel. Do you have any comments that you would like to make on the most recent things that are happening? Do you think we're, for example, at the beginning of a new intifada?
Well, I think that what's been happening for the last several years has been an extraordinary upsurge of nonviolent Palestinian mobilizations. What's different right now is that those mobilizations have moved from a few villages in the West Bank where there have been weekly nonviolent mobilizations of Palestinians backed by a few Israelis and some international supporters in villages like Bialin, Nahalin, in places where the so-called separation wall is stealing more and more Palestinian land. That level of nonviolent mobilization spread in the last couple of days right to Jerusalem in response to the Israeli announcement of its intention to begin building 1,600 new illegal homes for settlers in occupied Arab East Jerusalem as part of a planned 50,000 home increase in the occupied Jerusalem. And because of the attention that was being paid at that moment, for the reasons that had to do with the timing of the announcement, something that was of great embarrassment to the Obama administration, coming as it did with Vice President Biden being in Israel at that very moment when it was announced, it was seen as a direct slap in the face to the U.S. But for that reason, there's been a great deal more attention being paid than would ordinarily be the case. Unfortunately, so far, the U.S. response is 90% outrage at the timing and only 10% unease about the content. I think the question now is going to be how the Palestinian mobilizations go forward on the street. Clearly, there is not support on the street for the idea of going back into so-called proximity talks, a method of negotiations where the two parties don't even look at each other. They sit in separate hotels, even separate cities, separate countries, and the U.S. mediator, in this case, former Senator George Mitchell, who is the special envoy of President Obama, shuttles back and forth between them. That's what used to be used between Israel and the Palestinians back in the 1980s, when no Israeli diplomat was allowed to be face-to-face with someone from the PLO. That ended in the late 80s, early 90s, and the fact that we're going back to that now and calling it a victory is crazy. Luckily, most Palestinians on the street recognize that that is no victory, and they're opposed to it, so it's not at all clear that that's going to happen. I think the real question that we face right now is whether the U.S. ostensible outrage at the announcement of new settlement building is going to extend to the notion that settlement building is in its entirety, everywhere in the West Bank, everywhere in occupied East Jerusalem, and everywhere in Gaza at the time that the settlements were there. All of that is illegal and must be stopped. And the only way it's going to happen is not by a repeat of what we've seen before, where the Obama administration, like others before it, would say to Israel, please stop settlements. Israel says, no. Please stop settlements. Please freeze settlements. No. Please freeze a few settlements. No. Please freeze just a few settlements for just a little while and we'll exclude Jerusalem. Maybe. No. And then they stop asking. That's been the pattern. Real pressure, if their intention is pressure, means saying to Israel, settlement building is illegal and you promised to stop it. You need to stop it now. And when Israel says no, the answer is, you know that $30 billion of military aid that George Bush promised you and that President Obama agreed to implement? You can kiss it goodbye. That's pressure, and we haven't seen that yet.
This is obviously an ongoing story, and it's not the focus of this show, but I very much appreciate your analysis. I have tremendous respect for your many years of not just observing the situation there, but the whole Middle East and the interplay of the various political realities from Washington to the UN to the various governments and non-governmental entities in the area. But let's now move a little to the north and east, and that would be in Iraq and the recent elections that are going on there. Last week, it turned out that the predictions were President al-Maliki was in the lead, his coalition, and at that time he said he thought that the elections had been held in very proper order. But this morning, with the news that former Prime Minister Ayad Alawi's coalition is currently ahead, al-Maliki is saying, oh no, there was fraud. What comments do you have on that?
Well, it's very interesting developments. I think that there's no question that these elections are very troubled. How much it was direct fraud in terms of counting the votes and ballot stuffing and that sort of thing, we don't know yet. But clearly, holding an election under conditions still of military occupation by another country do not make for free and fair elections. The fact that U.S. officials and Iraqi officials and others extolled these elections for being so peaceful, that they didn't have large-scale violence. Imagine, Joy, in this country, on election day, if we had, and remember, we have 10 times the population of Iraq, but imagine even the same numbers, if we had at least 37 people killed in election violence and at least 140 incidents of violence across the country, would we be talking about that as a peaceful, free, and fair election? I don't think so. This is an indication of just how terrible the conditions in Iraq are today. Iraq remains occupied and at war while we pretend that it's all going well and we can pull out very soon, as if it was, as if the occupation was somehow making it calm and peaceful. Quite the opposite is true. Under this occupation, violence is rampant. And so I don't think we know exactly where the bad conditions of the election took place. But the results are becoming very interesting. Not only do we have al-Alawi's coalition appearing to, at least for the moment, be ahead of Prime Minister al-Maliki, but within the large Shia coalition, as of this morning, it appears that the party led by Muqtada al-Sadr, usually described as the, quote, fiery anti-American cleric,
Muqtada al-Sadr. That seems to go with his name in all press coverage. His party has now won a clear majority within the Shia alliance, and they won half the seats that have been identified so far in Baghdad, which is huge. So how this plays out is going to be very, very interesting. It's still very unclear. Not all the votes are counted yet, but these early trends are making clear that this is not going to be a straight shot for an obvious victory by al-Maliki's people.
Okay, and I noticed that it seemed that recently the violence in Iraq has actually been increasing even before the quote-unquote election season. But as for so many years when the focus was on Iraq and Afghanistan was the so-called forgotten war, it seems now that the focus is on Afghanistan, Iraq is the forgotten war.
Well, we should keep in mind that Iraq is still occupied by over 100,000 U.S. troops and over 150,000 U.S. paid contractors and mercenaries. So it's not surprising that that war continues. It is, as you say, something that we've been paying less attention to because it appears, and it seems to be true, that the trajectory of the war is towards a less aggressive role for the U.S. occupying forces. But they are still there. They are still playing a role. They are still provoking massive opposition. And we're seeing that playing out more and more.
Well, with the billions of dollars of investment that the U.S. has put into Iraq in infrastructure, and I'm thinking specifically of the embassy, the so-called embassy there, do you think that it's likely that the U.S. will ever leave Or do you think the situation may resolve itself somewhat similarly to the situation in Korea with the large number of troops still there after many decades?
Well, I think that on the level of troop presence for a very long time after the war, I think it will likely look very much like that. How it plays out, I don't think we know yet. It may be that a continuation of the largely U.S.-dependent and pro-U.S. government that al-Maliki represented, that some version of that will take power and will, quote, request that their U.S. allies, with all due respect for Iraq's sovereignty, et cetera, there will be great rhetorical focus on that, request additional time for U.S. troops to train the Iraqi military, that sort of thing. We already saw indications of that more than 2 years ago. We started hearing U.S. officials talking about the concept of remissioning U.S. troops, because, as you know, in the agreement signed between the U.S. and the Iraqi governments in the last weeks of the Bush administration in 2008, the agreement says explicitly that all U.S. combat troops, must be out of the country by the end of this summer, the summer of 2010. And at that time, we started already hearing people saying, well, but, you know, we may have to recommission. And then they started using the words remission some of those troops, meaning that combat troops, combat units, would be officially given a new mission, say training, but they would remain combat troops, and they would return to Iraq, or stay in Iraq, doing the same thing they've always done, what troops do, kill people and break things, but under the guise of doing training, of training the Iraqi military to kill people and break things in their own country.
We are speaking with Phyllis Bennis this morning on Forthright Radio, and we're eventually going to get to Afghanistan, which is the subject of her latest book.
We're moving around it.
Well, you cover such huge territory, the whole Middle East, and I have wanted to interview you for so long that I just have lots of questions. Very briefly, we'll head west, just very briefly. What do you have to say about Robert Ford's being put forth as possibly the ambassador to Syria after so many years of no ambassador to Syria?
Well, I think it's clear that the Obama administration, and this is one of the areas where it does distinguish itself from its predecessor, from the Bush years, is trying to remake U.S. relations with Syria, having some moves towards normalization. Now, how much of this is sincere as an effort to reengage with a country from whom the U.S. has been quite walled off for many years, and how much of it is a tactical slash strategic effort to woo Syria away from Iran, I don't think we know yet. I mean, clearly the U.S. has an interest in it's challenging Iran, it's competing with Iran for influence throughout the region. Syria is one of the targets of that campaign for influence, if you will. So the cynic in me, which masquerades as the more experienced policy analyst, says this is about winning greater U.S. support from Syria and away and winning Syria away from Iranian influence. The idealist in me, which doesn't have much energy these days but rears its little head every now and then, says this is something that the Obama administration is trying to do differently from the Bush years and trying to reestablish ties with what is obviously an important and influential country in the region.
Okay, well, that you've brought up Iran. Let's head east and speak just a little bit about Iran. The reports are that the U.S. is sending bunker buster bombs in the direction and ostensibly, potentially, to be used against Iran. What can you tell us about that?
Well, this is one of those pieces of information that can be read a bunch of different ways. First of all, the shipment of bombs that was sent were identified in a fairly broad category that includes bunker busters, but also includes a number of other kinds of weapons. There's nothing good about the U.S. sending weapons to Diego Garcia. That's first thing. Diego Garcia itself is an island off Africa, very far from Africa, that used to be a British colony and was turned over to the U.S. at the expense of the Chagosian people who were the native peoples of that island, something we hear almost nothing about until a wonderful researcher at American University named David Vine wrote their story for the U.S. It was a story that was not told in this country. And these people, the native people of that island, who had lived there for centuries, for generations, were packed up and forcibly expelled from the island, dumped on the pier, essentially, in Mauritius, and have been struggling ever since to get back to their land, to which they are not allowed even to go to visit. So that's the first thing. There's nothing good about the U.S. sending more military supplies and bombs to its bases around the world. It's more than 1,000 overseas bases, especially to the big one at Diego Garcia. Now, whether those bombs are intended for Iran is a somewhat open question. I don't happen to believe that a U.S. Military strike on Iran is it's certainly not imminent, and I don't even think it's necessarily in the works. I think part of what we're seeing is an effort to raise the stakes, because what is going on is an effort to get new, quote, crippling sanctions imposed against Iran. And for that, the U.S. needs support from all of the other members of the U.N. Security Council, something that's very difficult to achieve. And I think that one of the messages that's going on here in this game of ratcheting up the rhetoric, it's to remind people once again that, yes, all options are on the table. And in President Obama's unfortunate use of his words, yes, we can is part of what's being said here. Yes, we can attack Iran if we choose to. And I think the leak was probably rather deliberately made to make sure that the world knew. I think that we need to keep the pressure on in Congress, on the administration, to say that certainly any military strike and indeed a military threat against Iran is itself a violation of the UN Charter, and is something that does not make the U.S. safer. It puts us at much greater risk. So I think that we're dealing with a very complicated set of circumstances here. The problem is that for many people, the idea of escalating sanctions is somehow better. It's somehow not violent. It's not like war. The problem is imposing a blockade, which is one of the aspects of what the U.S. is talking about doing when it talks about prohibiting Iran's access to refined gasoline, something that is used by the entire population. This is not something that is in the control of the government or Ahmadinejad or the Republican Guards or anybody else. this is an economic lifeline for the entire population of that large country, is an act of war under some circumstances. So I think that we have to get away from this notion that, well, maybe war isn't a good idea, but we definitely should be escalating sanctions. What we should be escalating is diplomacy. We should be opening new talks, and they should be regional. And on the nuclear question, we should be looking regional as well. We should be supporting the long-standing Egyptian and other countries' proposal for a nuclear weapons-free zone across the Middle East. That would mean even more inspections, more intrusive inspections of every country, including Iran, but also including Israel, the only nuclear power in the region, which has an arsenal of between 200 and 300 high-density nuclear bombs in Dimona, which are not acknowledged, are not under the inspection regimes of the United Nations through the IAEA, and are essentially allowed to exist under U.S. protection. That should end. If there were a regional move to prohibit nuclear weapons anywhere in the entire region would sleep a lot better, and frankly, so would I.
And I would as well. We're speaking with Phyllis Bennis, and her latest book, Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, a Primer. I'd like us to segue into the situation in Afghanistan. Our listeners are pretty well versed with the history of Afghanistan, much of the history of the last 30 years. I think, however, it gets forgotten what Iran's role was at the beginning of the current invasion and occupation of Afghanistan in those dreadful weeks and months after the September 11th, 2001 World Trade Center and Pentagon bombings. Refresh our memories about Iran's role then.
Sure, and I must say, if your listeners are up to speed on that, it speaks very well of the importance of public and community-based radio. This is why we need it, because we don't get this from the mainstream media. The role that Iran played was a fascinating one. It was quite unified with the U.S. In fact, the U.S. Special envoy sent by President Bush to represent the U.S. in the negotiations that led to the convening of the conference in Bonn of Afghan exiles that created the first post-Taliban Afghan government under the sponsorship of the U.S., he wrote later that his closest diplomatic allies were the Iranians in the effort to establish a stable government in Afghanistan. Iran had had very tense relations with the Taliban. They were not just ideological, but political competitors in many ways. And Iran was quite happy to see the Taliban overthrown, although obviously not thrilled with the notion that it was going to be followed by a decade or more long U.S. occupation. But in that early period, it was Iran that provided the most important diplomatic backing it was a guy named James Dobbins. Ambassador James Dobbins was the U.S. Representative, and in his writing, and we quote this extensively in the book that I did with David Wildman, Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, explaining exactly what the Iranian role was, and it was a very positive one from the vantage point of U.S. official efforts to establish a stable and, pro-Western government in Afghanistan after the overthrow of the Taliban, when the Taliban had fled.
And refresh our memory of what international law says about the U.S. invasion and occupation. I think that the waters have become very muddied about that. I think the mythology is that the U.N. authorized the invasion. Could you clarify this for us, Phyllis?
Yeah, Guinness? The U.N. did not authorize any invasion. The UN Charter, which is a wonderful document, but it's vague on a lot of stuff, is very clear on a few things. And one of the things it's very clear about is, when is a war legal? It's one of those horrific things that international law tries to do, is figure out how to regulate war, instead of just saying any violence anywhere by anybody against anybody is ipso facto illegal. It doesn't say that. It says under some circumstances, wars are illegal, and they're basically legal under two sets of circumstances. The first is if the Security Council of the United Nations authorizes it. That was the case, unfortunately, back in 1990 when the Security Council authorized the U.S. war against Iraq at that time. It was, you know, we can look back, and I have in an earlier book, at the all of the examples of bribes and threats and punishments that were used to gain that support, but nonetheless, they managed to do it. They got the vote to pass the resolution authorizing that war. So while that war was illegitimate and immoral, it was not technically illegal. In the case of Iraq, the Security Council did not authorize a military response. And what's important is that the other way that a war can be legal is on the question of self-defense. The UN Charter is very clear. The world is organized on the basis of nation states, and nothing in the UN Charter takes away a country's right of immediate self-defense. But self-defense is a very precisely defined category. It's not some generic idea of anything that anybody wants to call self-defense will be self-defense. It is, rather, a very specific set of circumstances, and it uses two caveats. It says a nation has the right to defend itself against an armed attack if an armed attack occurs. Okay, that certainly happened. Until the Security Council can meet to decide what to do about that threat. So, for example, in the case of 9/11, when the second plane was heading towards the Twin Towers, and it was clear at that point that it was part of an attack and not simply a pilot gone astray, the U.S. government at that moment had the right to horrifically even shoot down that plane if they had scrambled a jet to take it down. That would have been a legal act of immediate self-defense. Instead, what they did was go to war some weeks later, against another country where none of the hijackers were from Afghanistan. None of them were Afghans. They were from Egypt. They were Saudis. They didn't live in Afghanistan. They lived in Hamburg. They didn't train in Afghanistan. They trained in Florida. They didn't go to flight school in Afghanistan. They went to flight school in Minnesota. So the notion that we were going to go to war against another country because the person who may have inspired them was being protected by a government of that country was way too much of a stretch. Then we get to the question of until the Security Council can meet. Well, the Security Council met less than 24 hours after the attacks. On the morning after, the Security Council met to consider the U.S. drafted resolution at a moment when the U.N. itself felt it had been threatened as well, when diplomats were shaken to the core. Many of them had family and friends in Lower Manhattan. They may have had friends who were dead or missing. It was at a moment when we didn't know how many thousands of people were dead. The refuge was at Ground Zero was still smoldering. It was a moment of absolute extraordinary fear. But the council met and voted unanimously, as everyone in the world knew they would, to support the U.S. resolution. They not only raised their hands, they stood in solidarity. It was that moment of great human solidarity with us as Americans that we were hearing from all over the world. So the question was, what was in that resolution that they passed with such fervor? And what was in it was a very mild call for collaboration on tracing money trails, some detailed issues about establishing an anti-terrorism committee in the council, but clearly nothing that authorized the use of force. It was not taken under the conditions of Chapter 7 of the UN Charter, a prerequisite to authorizing force, and that wasn't something anybody forgot. That was a deliberate decision by the Bush administration because they did not want the United Nations to be granted the recognition that the UN and the UN alone has the authority to determine the legality of an armed attack. The U.S. was determined to do this alone, and that's why the attack from the beginning was illegal. Months later, the UN did collapse its resistance and did authorize the continuing presence of a military force. But the initial invasion and attack and overthrow of the government was done completely illegally.
We're speaking with Phyllis Bennis, and as promised, we are going to open the phone lines. And if you want to join this conversation, you can do so by calling 895-2448. That's 895-2448. We're going to continue our conversation, and because our phone system cuts people off, I may actually put you online while Phyllis is still speaking. Please don't speak until I say, welcome, you're on the air. And we'll take our first phone call, and welcome, you're on Forthright Radio.
Good morning.
Good morning.
How are you doing today?
Fine. Let's be very quick, okay?
Excuse me?
Please state your question, and let's move along.
Well, it's actually a little comment about what I've heard this morning so far. Is that okay?
Yes, just please be brief.
Okay. You started out by saying the troubles with the Palestinians in the Israeli territories. And I thought, shouldn't it be the troubles with the Israelis in the Palestinian territories? And I thought, no, it's actually the troubles with anybody in Israeli-occupied territory, which is East Jerusalem, all the rest of the Palestinian territories, Washington, D.C. The Israelis are occupying the world. The Israelis are the warmongers of the world. And Phyllis Bennis, if you don't know that there weren't 19 Arab hijackers that flew those planes, or no planes, and no bomb, no plane flew into the Pentagon, I don't know what kind of reporting you're doing. And your show, when you're putting out that information, is totally disinformation. That is not the truth of what happened.
All right. Thank you for your call. We'll have Phyllis respond.
Well, I'll just respond to the first part of what he said, which is that it's exactly right that the Israeli-occupied territory includes all of East Jerusalem, all of the West Bank, and all of Gaza. Israelis are certainly among the warmongering countries in the world. They're hardly the only ones. I think our own country bears a great deal of responsibility around the world. Thank you.
Good morning, caller. You're on the air. I'm asking callers to be brief because we have so much that we want to hear from Phyllis. Please begin.
Good morning. Good morning, Phyllis.
Morning.
Always a pleasure to read your work.
Thank you.
Two quick questions. Number one, about a month ago, there was an article from Haaretz that was making the rounds of the progressive blogosphere, and the first sentence of the article said, and I'm paraphrasing here, that virtually every member of the U.S. Senate and Congress is vetted by the Israel lobby. Following up on that, could you give us an estimate, to the best of your ability, what percentage of our Congress are ideologically in tune with the Israel firsters, and what percentage are just fearful of getting the wrath of the Israel lobby to prevent them from being reelected? Question number two, Professor Finkelstein, in his new book, seems to indicate that he is detecting a very slow and gradual and yet noticeable shift in American Jewish attitudes about backing Israel no matter what they do. So if you could answer those two, I'd appreciate it. Thanks.
Sure.
Thank you
very
for the
important
question.
Questions. On the first one, I don't think I can say numbers of who's ideologically behind the sort of Israel first position. I do know that it's a very small minority. It's a huge majority of people. When I talk to people on the Hill and when I talk to people who have been lobbying their members of Congress from all over the country, we hear constantly members of Congress saying some version of, you know, I'm really with you, but I can't afford to take the risk. And the risk is twofold, and this is what segues right into your second question. The risk is partly about money. This is what the pro-Israeli lobbies, and we're not only talking about AIPAC and the Council of Presidents and the other long-standing, largely Jewish pro-Israeli organizations, we're also talking about the newer but also very influential lobbies that are affiliated with the Christian right, the Christian Zionist organizations like Kufi, for example, Christians United for Israel, and others who have actually more influence in the Republican Party and historically in the White House than the pro-Israeli, the Jewish pro-Israeli lobbies that have concentrated more on Congress and in the Democratic Party. But they parallel each other's interests in many ways. The money is certainly a huge issue. I know of one example of a member of Congress who said, look, I'd love to vote with you, but I can't take the risk. It will cost me $250,000 given to my opponent if I don't vote this way. And I think we see that over and over again. What we don't see any longer, and this is what goes to your second question, based on what my good friend Norman Finkelstein said, I absolutely agree with him, except I don't think it's small. I think there is a huge shift underway, and I think it's very visible, in changing opinions within the Jewish community, but also beyond the Jewish community. And that is that AIPAC and organizations like it can no longer really even claim to speak for the Jewish community. In many ways, AIPAC never did represent all of the U.S. Jewish population, which is far from monolithic on every issue, but even on the question of Israel. I mean, certainly Jews like me are probably a minority in the Jewish community, but not by much these days. Well, maybe Jews like me are still a minority, but Jews who are very critical of Israel are no longer a tiny, insignificant minority. They are a huge component of the U.S. Jewish community. And one of the best indicators of that was in the last election, where not only AIPAC, but every one of the pro-Israeli organizations operating in the Jewish community at various points in the primaries or elsewhere came out against President Obama and urged voters not to vote for President Obama. He wasn't sufficiently supportive of Israel, whatever. And yet, 78% of Jewish voters voted for Barack Obama.
Phyllis,
so no longer can AIPAC claim to be able to deliver votes. It can still deliver cash, but it can't any longer deliver votes. And that means its influence is going to decrease.
Phyllis,
you have the rise of organizations like J Street, which is a new Jewish lobby directly challenging AIPAC as its sort of identity. That's huge. I mean, I have my differences with AIPAC's approach on many things, but that doesn't matter. What matters is they have broken the taboo. You have the work of one of the organizations I work with, the U.S. Campaign to End Israeli Occupation, which has about, 330, 340 member organizations around the country. Probably two dozen of them are explicitly Jewish organizations. Jews for Peace in Palestine and Israel, Jewish Voice for Peace. That one has chapters all over the country. Jews Against the Occupation, there's a bunch of them. So, you know, I think that there is no question about the level of shift in this discourse within the Jewish community and among people in the United States in general.
Phyllis, we have a patient caller who would like to join this conversation also. Thank you so much for waiting. You're on the air on Forthright Radio.
Thank you so much for bringing Phyllis to our airwaves. And Phyllis, thank you so much for your work. I think there's a lot of people listening who are familiar with your work. So the question I called in with was, for people who agree, are basically aligned with your political stance and your analysis, what do you think is the most effective use of time, energy, and money? However, while I was listening on the phone and hearing you speak, I think there is a real insufficiency in people understanding the agenda of the right-wing Christian Zionists. And I think if you would take a couple of moments and elucidate about that, I think it does almost never get spoken about, and we can't underestimate it, so thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
For that.
On the second question first, just briefly, organizations like KUFI have both a political and a theological agenda. The political is to ally themselves with Israel. They're also, as you mentioned, very right-wing. The bottom line is that they're ultimately really anti-Semitic. And I got to tell you, as a Jew, they make me really nervous. The theological basis of their work is based on the idea, just very simply, that the second coming of Jesus can't happen until all the Jews are gathered in Israel, in one place. So that's why they support not just the state of Israel, but the Zionist project of what's known as ingathering, getting all the Jews to go to Israel. The problem is, I mean, that's problematic enough, but the problem beyond that is that their theology teaches them that at such point that all the Jews are gathered in Israel, they will all either convert or die. And that will lead to the second coming. So I got to say, as a Jew, not a great choice, convert or die. So that's kind of the basis of who these, the basis. I mean, there's others, obviously, there's people all over the map. But organizations like Sabeel, the U.S. what is it called, U.S. Friends of Sabeel, Friends of Sabeel North America, actually, I think is the correct name, is a very important organization based on support for the Sabeel Center in Jerusalem, a Christian ecumenical center that works specifically on challenging Christian Zionism, and they do terrific work all over the country. So if people are interested in that, you can go to their website. It's FOSNA, F-O-S-N-A, Friends of Sabeel North America, .org, and take a look at their work here. They were recently in the Bay Area and Marin and Seattle and Honolulu on a traveling conference just in the last few weeks. On the broader question of what's the most important thing, it's a really hard question, because right now I think we're at a period where we need a very new kind of anti-war and anti-militarism movement. This is not the same as organizing during the Bush years. Even though the wars have not changed very much, the political moment is very different. The political conditions are very different. The American people are very different. Having elected an African-American president for the country grounded not just in racism, but in slavery and genocide is a huge transformation. And the celebration of that, particularly, but not only, in the black community, is still enormous and should be continually celebrated. And the fact that it was made possible by the coming together of this huge mobilization, not because Barack Obama was the first choice of those in power. Yes, he had been vetted. Yes, he had been found acceptable. But he wasn't by far the first choice. He was swept into power. And that changes things. So we need to adapt to that. Plus, we are living through the greatest economic crisis in 60 years. That changes everything. So I think that all of that together means that we need a very different kind of anti-war mobilization, and that includes the work on stopping the war in Afghanistan, ensuring a real withdrawal from Iraq, and challenging U.S. support for Israeli occupation. What that means is that we need, for example, to have an anti-war component to the broad movement for economic rights that is rising in response to the economic crisis. Organizations that are demanding money for jobs, money for education, money for health care. Where's that money going to come from? It's going to come out of the military budget. When President Obama says that only the military budget of all of the discretionary funds available will not be frozen, that's when we have to rise up with the unions, with the health care workers, and say, wait a minute, that money cannot be spent. We are spending this year $1 trillion when you add together the official military budget, which is about $740 billion, the money spent on nuclear weapons in the Treasury Department, and the hundreds of billions spent to go to war in Iraq and Afghanistan. We're talking $1 trillion. And when we wonder why we don't have money for health care, that's the answer. So I think the mobilization we need to be doing is to bring our information, the links between the cost of war and the lack of health care, the lack of jobs. I recommend that people look at the work of the National Priorities Project that makes those links on the basis of every city, every county, every congressional district, every state, how much money your state, your city has paid and is paying, and what could that money, if it were not being spent on the war in Iraq or the war in Afghanistan or the military budget, how many Head Start programs could it start? How many new police officers could it put to work? How many homes could be retrofitted with green technology? All of those things are what we need to bring to those movements. So I think more than building a separate peace movement in this period, I think we need to be building a component of that broader movement. More than being in the streets, yes, being in the streets is important sometimes, but I think more the education side, the mobilization side, getting the unions the information about the fact that the escalation in Afghanistan alone, the 30,000 new troops, each of whom costs $1 million for 1 year in Afghanistan, that escalation could provide instead 660,000 new green, well-paid union jobs.
Phyllis,
that's what we need to provide to the unions.
Phyllis, we're going to take one more call who's been waiting very patiently, and then I'm going to ask the callers to stop calling because I want to give Phyllis enough time to talk about her plan for ending the U.S. war in Afghanistan. Thank you very much for being so patient. You're on Forthright Radio.
Thank you, Joy and Phyllis, for coming to KZYX and your detailed responses to our questions. The situation with Rachel Corrie, who was murdered by bulldozer while standing up for Palestinian housing, and Tristan Anderson, who was horribly mutilated by a tear gas canister fired into a crowd in which he was in protesting the same Israeli destruction of Palestinian areas. What is the likely outcome of the Rachel Corrie case in Israel and Tristan Anderson's situation in light of the possibility of that being brought up in Israeli behavior, especially the fact that these are two American citizens having been assaulted, and in light of dealing with the overall situation as you've outlined, along with the costs of treating our citizens this way? And thank you for being here today.
Thanks a lot for your question. Of course, and it's perfectly timed. Yesterday, of course, was the anniversary of the 2003, March 16th, 2003, murder of Rachel Corrie, and her trial is underway right now. It's in its fourth day today in Haifa. There's been some extraordinary developments, including the acknowledgement by the Israeli physician who did the autopsy was forced to admit that he went ahead with the autopsy without allowing the representative of the U.S. Embassy there, despite having been told by the Israeli government that the U.S. Embassy representative had a right to be there and that Rachel's parents were requiring that. He went ahead anyway. As a result, the judge asked Rachel's family if they wanted to add additional charges to the punishment component of the trial, meaning if there would be more, if they won, if they prevailed, they would get more money on the basis of punishment, not just the costs of what, you know, the way they calculate the cost in a wrongful death action. And to their extraordinary credit, these amazing people, Cindy and Craig Corrie and their daughter Rachel, their daughter Sarah, Rachel's older sister, made the decision that, yes, they would add the additional charges, but the only money they added was $1, symbolic, because they said the most important thing is not the money, it's holding these people accountable so that the practice will change inside Israel. It was an extraordinary statement by an extraordinary family.
Phyllis, I'm going to ask that you end that part of the question now because we are so out of time, and
right.
I want us to have a chance to hear what you are proposing for the way to end U.S. war in Afghanistan, and we only have a few more minutes, and I'm so sorry. The callers who are still trying to get in, I'm going to dedicate the end of the show to just hearing what Phyllis Bennis has to say.
Well, thank you, and thank you all for calling. I'm sorry for talking too much. I spoke of this earlier in answering one of the earlier questions, and I think the bottom line is we need to build a new kind of anti-war and anti-militarism and pro-peace movement. We need two things. We need a component of the broad movement for economic rights, meaning we have to go to the unions, to the immigrant rights organizations, to the people working for health care, and bring to them this information about the cost of war and the intersection of why, aside from the fact that these wars are illegal, that they don't keep us safe, they make us less safe, and they are immoral, aside from all of that, aside from the human cost to our young soldiers and especially to Afghan and Iraqi civilians, that it's also too expensive. We can't afford it at a time of economic crisis in our country. And we need to make that that position easily accessible, easy to get the numbers, the examples, the models to that movement and be a small part of that movement. We're not going to be the centerpiece of it. The peace movement was the centerpiece of the fight back during the Bush years. We're not going to be during the Obama period. We also need a separate peace movement, yes, that is working with organizations like the organizations that were around United for Peace and Justice, like Move On, like Win Without War, like some of these broader organizations. The key constituencies like Military Families Speak Out and Veterans for Peace and Iraq Veterans Against the War, the unions that are being mobilized through U.S. Labor Against the War. These are the kinds of constituency-based organizing that we're going to need to do in a much broader way than we did before with the hope of bringing into motion that extraordinary mobilization that exists to elect President Obama, that will now have to be there, as Cornel West describes it, to correct after we elect. Now we have to correct what President Obama is doing. And we have to fight enough that there will be a necessity in Washington, not only in the administration but in Congress as well, that it will simply be too expensive politically not to do the right thing. They will have to do the right thing because the cost is simply too high not to.
One of the things that you quoted in your book is, you said, one of the military people said, we haven't been fighting in Afghanistan for 8 years. We've been fighting in Afghanistan for 1 year, 8 years in a row.
Yeah, and I think that the strategy that the U.S. is imposing is a losing strategy. We're seeing it shifting constantly. We're reading in the Washington Post front page yesterday about a Marine unit gone rogue that is sending 3,000 Marines to occupy one tiny little area near outside of Marja, where the offensive is underway, not far from Kandahar. And they're doing the right thing, right? They're meeting with local people. There is an understanding of that, that when things are done locally, it's a whole different thing than trying to impose a national government. But at the end of the day, if you're serious about that, you're talking about an occupation force of probably over 1 million troops. That's not going to happen. That shouldn't happen. That can't happen, and it can't work. So what they're doing is not working. And I think that one example, and I'll close with this, for those who think that even if the war in Afghanistan was wrong and it wasn't a good war, we have to stay because if the Taliban come back, it will be so bad for the women of Afghanistan. Here's one example of what almost 9 years of U.S. occupation has actually meant for the women of Afghanistan. Afghanistan in those 9 years has gone from number 3 to number 1 in the UN's ratings for the country with the highest level of maternal mortality in the world. And UNICEF, it has gone from number 2 to number 1 as the worst country in the world for a child to be born. That's what we have given to the women and the children of Afghanistan by our invasion and occupation. It has now beaten out Sierra Leone for the highest number of women dying in childbirth and as the worst place for a child to be born and expect to live to their first or fifth birthday. That's our gift to the people of Afghanistan through this war. We need to do it differently, as people, not as a military force occupying, as people providing all the things for that debt, that huge debt that we owe the people of Iraq and the people of Afghanistan. We can only do that after we end the occupation. It's only step one, but it's the necessary step.
Well, Phyllis Bennis, we so appreciate your many decades of work. Your latest book, Ending the U.S. War in Afghanistan, A Primer, which you wrote with David Wildman, is very useful. And I hope you would be willing to come back again soon, because there's so much that we were not able to cover in today's discussion. And as
I'd
you can
be delighted.
And you can tell from our listeners are very engaged in this.
Absolutely. I'm delighted to hear that, too.
Yeah, well, thank you. So, and it's because of your work that they know as much as they know, or we know as much as we know. Thank you
very much. Thanks a lot.
All right. Bye-bye. Forthright Radio is a Beyond the Deep End production, broadcast live each first and third Wednesday of the month from the Philo Studios of KZYX and Z Mendocino County Public Broadcasting. Engineer Ann Newport, General Factotum Evert Traber, I'm Joy LeClaire. Our email address is forthrightradio@gmail.com. For a copy of this or any other Forthright Radio show, contact Rich Culbertson at 895-2324, and please allow up to 4 weeks for delivery. Since it's St. Patrick's Day, we're going to hear David Rovick's St. Patrick Battalion.
My name is John Riley. I'll have your ear only a while. I left my dear home in Ireland. It was death, starvation, or exile. When I got to America, it was my duty to go. Enter the army and slog across Texas to join in the war against Mexico. And it was there in the pueblos and hillsides that I saw the mistake I had made. part of a conquering army with the morals of a bayonet blade. And they're amidst all these poor dying Catholics, screaming children, the burning stench of it all. Myself and 200 Irishmen decided to rise to the call. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We marched neath the green flag of St. Patrick, emblazoned with Erin Gobrah, bright with the harp and the shamrock, and Libertad para la República. Just 50 years after Wolf Tone, 5,000 miles away, the Yanks called us a legion of strangers, and they can talk as they may. But from Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We fought them in Matamoros while their volunteers were raping the nuns. In Monterrey and Cerro Gordo, we fought on as Ireland's sons. We were the red-headed fighters for freedom amidst these brown-skinned women and men. Side by side we fought against tyranny, and I dare say we'd do it again. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. The last, overwhelmed by the cannons from Boston, we fell after each mortar blast. Most of us died on that hillside in the service of the Mexican state. So far from our occupied homeland, we were heroes and victims of fate. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. From Dublin City to San Diego, we witnessed freedom denied. So we formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side. We formed the St. Patrick Battalion, and we fought on the Mexican side.